Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak to Reason senior editors Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangu Ward, and Matt Welch, all of whom are coming to us from their own freedom bunkers from across America to give us their thoughts on news of the day, which today will include the Antifa at Berkeley, the pardon of Joe Arpaio, and Senator Al Franken as an actual possible presidential candidate. But before we do that, we're going to talk about Hurricane Harvey and the federal government's response to it. The city of Houston was racked by Hurricane Harvey over the weekend, which is weird because it's in a red state and we have a deal with God, but it nonetheless happened. And so people have been evacuated. The entire city is underwater, and all sorts of nasty, terrible things are happening there. The hurricane has now been downgraded from a hurricane to something else, but flooding persists. And responses trickling in include rage to any perceived price gouging. Yesterday, the Texas Attorney General said that if you gouge anybody that's over the age of 65, that's up to a $250,000 fine. There have been complaints of $99 bottles of water. And on a macro level, congressional Republicans are debating whether or not to continue the flood relief program, which is, of course, a major factor in national disasters like this. Our own Catherine Mangu Ward wrote a piece at Reason over the weekend that, among other things, extolled the virtues of price gouging. So, Catherine, do you like price gouging because you're an evil, heartless capitalist, or is this just kind of a sport thing you do?
Why can't it be both, Heaton? It's both. No, I mean, this is a thing that you hear every single time that something goes wrong, man-made, natural disasters, what have you. Price gougers are heroes. I will fully stand by that sentence. They should be given rewards later, not fined. People who go into disaster zones, we generally praise them, except for if one of the motivations among many is to make money, and then suddenly they're villains. That's ridiculous. The people who were selling water for $99 were doing it because otherwise there would be zero water, not for all the money in the world. And that is not something we should be upset about. At the same time, we are, of course, eternally subsidizing people to build and rebuild and rebuild in areas that are prone to natural disasters, that are prone to flooding. I think the city of Galveston, God bless them, has been underwater more than they've been dry. And this is the federal government incentivizing people to do something that is ultimately harmful to them. You know, the idea that people are responding to fiscal incentives, to monetary incentives, to put back up their vacation homes is something that actually John Stossel did a cover story for Reason Magazine about, I think, in the Nick Gillespie era. So maybe Nick can tell us about that time that John Stossel was a welfare queen.
Ah, the Nick Gillespie era. I remember that. Nick, you want to weigh in?
They printed the magazine only in black and white then. It was so long ago.
It does seem that. And we only had 24 letters in the alphabet. So, you know, it was primitive, but we did what we could, and we were happy to have it. Stossel had talked about how I think he had a beach house somewhere out in the Hamptons or, you know, in a ritzy part of Long Island that kept getting washed away, and then he would be able to get federal. He had federal flood insurance and would get rebuilding funds from taxpayers, even though he's a millionaire plus. And I think some of those programs have stopped, but this is an interesting side story to questions about weather events and the amount of damage that they cause, because it's clear that people want to keep building in places that are really prone to flooding. Houston has been growing massively over the past 20 or 30 years. Back in the 80s, it passed Philadelphia and became, I think, the fourth or fifth largest city, and it's continuing to move up. It's going to be passing Chicago pretty soon for a lot of reasons, and they have not done a very good job of figuring out how to control water, which, of course, can be done and should be done, one of the problems with the Houston storm, beyond everything else, is that we're going to hear a lot about how this is proof positive of climate change, so that we all have to stop driving cars for the next couple of hundred years, and also that somehow the federal government and local governments need to get more and more in charge of doing stuff that as Catherine alluded to, you know, by subsidizing living in areas that are prone to weather events, we're only going to see more and more weather events, regardless of how big or bad the storms are or not.
There, I should point out, because it's just one of those weird quirks of legislation, that the federal flood and fire insurance guarantees, and I think the term of art is FIRE, F-I-R-E, I'll forget what that stands for, came about in 1968 in the wake of the widespread post-Martin Luther King riots. It was an insurance program that was designed in spirit, or sold at the time, as, look, there's going to be places, mostly inner cities, where insurance companies are either going to be too afraid or too racist to write insurance policies, and people should be able to nonetheless still be able to build their homes there. And then, as applied, it basically allowed there to be an extra subsidy for, Johnny Carson to build a bigger house in Malibu. Something like 80% of the insurance policies that are written under that are for people who aren't just like doing pretty well, but are goddamn rich. So it didn't go to where it was. But I want to throw out there, in addition to, you know, monocle wearing Catherine Mengu Ward's love for price gouging, there's been some really inspiring kind of tales and images that have come out of this horrific thing. I think we were up to like 500,000 people now are going to be sheltered somewhere, at least. But I think everyone has seen the images of the Cajun Navy coming down out there, just a bunch of people hauling tiny boats in their trucks to help people out. We always forget this, even while it's being demonstrated in front of our own eyes. But the first responder in natural disaster isn't the heroic Coast Guard who does a great job in these situations. It isn't the EMT. It's the neighbor. It is the first person there. 99% of our transactions have nothing to do with the government. And a lot of people are voluntarily getting out there and behaving in very heroic ways under an arduous, biblical circumstances of there just being a tremendous amount of rain and nowhere for all that rain to go.
If I can jump in, I was going to say, this is also conceivably a defining moment for the Trump presidency in terms of showing some basic competency. Both George Bush, obviously, with Katrina, that was, as much as his foreign policy and his economic policies were a complete bust, and his spending policies, his response to Katrina was particularly ruinous of, confidence and faith in his ability to actually run the government. And in a very significant way, Obama had the same problem with the Gulf oil spill, partly because it was actually federal regulators who were asleep on that job with the BP oil spill. And Obama said, at one point publicly that he was going to be looking through the agencies he controlled to find somebody's ass to kick. And he really should have been kicking his own. And so, in each of the past two presidencies, we've had a major kind of man-made event that somehow reflected poorly on the federal government's inability or ability to actually do its job and execute its duties. Trump has already said, and our managing editor at Reason.com, Mark Lischron, who lives in Austin, has a piece up about this. But, Trump has promised to come on Tuesday if it's not too disruptive, et cetera. But, if FEMA can actually act well here, it'll be a real change, and hopefully that will happen. But for some of the reasons that Catherine pointed out at Reason over the weekend, as well as recent history, it's unlikely that that's going to happen. But this is actually a place where Trump could come through looking comparatively well compared to the last two guys in the Oval Office.
We published a piece a few years back about the recovery in Joplin, Missouri, which was an interesting case study. I think the guys at the Mercatus Center also studied it because it was disaster recovery where the local authorities basically kept the feds out. And it's a really, really interesting story. I urge you to check it out at Reason. But it's among other things, they managed to waive virtually all of the bureaucratic requirements around zoning and building in the area. And they did it in part by local officials saying, you know, better to ask forgiveness than permission. And I hope that we can see some of that in Texas. I think if there's anywhere that can embrace the idea that people should be allowed to build whatever they want, whenever they want, wherever they want, in order to live their lives, it's Houston, which has a great record of being a kind of a free for all city that is a success in terms of zoning, in terms of building. So I am actually a little bit hopeful on that front. Again, if they can just, you know, and again, trust Texas for this, if they can keep the feds out, they can keep their elbows out and just let people come in and build without having to use certified contractors, without having to get everything approved through City Hall because City Hall is underwater anyway. That kind of thing, I think, could make a huge, huge difference in whether it's a Katrina length recovery period or something that looks more like Joplin.
Catherine, can I rag you a little bit more about price gouging, or at least talk to you about that?
Yes, I will talk all day about the metals I want to put on gougers. Well,
wonderful, wonderful. So one of the things that I have found interesting the last couple of years is I think when maybe this was 4 or 5 years ago when a hurricane came through New York where I was and New Jersey as well, everybody hated price gougers. You know, Chris Christie was waddling out to lay into price gougers and yell at price gougers and all these things. And I was explaining to a couple of my friends that it operates as a market mechanism. It's a big signal flare that people should go buy gasoline. If you can sell gasoline for $20 a gallon, more people go get gasoline, and it brings it into the market. So everybody gets more gasoline. Everybody gets more bottles of water. And the response that I got that I thought was very interesting was, I don't care. The people that I spoke to, and it was pretty much across the board, went, we don't care if the greater good is aided by this. People are making money off of it, and that's so anathema to us on a moral level that we would rather have less stuff. Do you think that that's a hump we can ever get over?
No, I think this is actually a really, really deep problem with our politics and the way so many people think about the world. They would rather have things be more fair, more equally divided, more even, than actually objectively better. And this is the fundamental objection to capitalism. I mean, this is the whole idea here. Yes, of course, rich people get more stuff when stuff costs money, but there is more stuff overall when people are able to produce for the rich. And this is true on the absolute, absolute micro level of, yes, prices contain information. And the information that gets sent out very, very strongly in disasters is we need canned food, we need water, we need fuel, we need generators, we need batteries. And people get in, they fill up their trucks with the stuff people need and drive them into places that are not yet 100% safe. And they do it because they know they can make money. And that is a hugely important piece of information that we would not have without prices. It's on the total macro scale, and the instinctual response to that as something bad is the problem with our politics.
I want to push back, Catherine, against you and Andrew here of like this Spock, you know, Vulcan understanding of things. It's because if you're in the middle of a disaster, and again, I'm against laws, you know, that prohibit so-called price gouging. And I obviously understand supply and demand, but what flips most people out is the idea that like in the middle of an emergency, when poor people, you know, and the poor always suffer more, you know, if water goes up to $20 for a 12-ounce bottle or gasoline costs $20 for a gallon or something like that, people are pissed because it's an extreme version. And I would be very slow to analogize, you know, the beauty of capitalism in extreme situations. In the sense that, you know, during Katrina, Walmart took a whole bunch of shit for free down to the affected areas and were generally turned back by government authorities and things like that. But it's true that a lot of businesses actually go out of their way to give stuff away for free. And they bring in, they bring in the water, they bring in the goods and services and stuff like
that. Anti-charity here, right? No, like people who go and do it for free are praiseworthy as well.
But I'm just saying, like, it's understandable, I think, from a libertarian perspective, why people get pissed if when prices go up. And it's like, it might be understandable. And it's true that, you know, when we saw this in Katrina, and we see this after every big storm, if there are price controls put on what contractors and cleanup crews and other people are able to charge, you get fewer of them. And that's a real problem. And in a lot of ways, you know, the problem of severe weather events, or whatever we're calling them now, is really the rebuilding afterwards, because that's where all of the graft, that's where all of the kind of collusion and all of the fuck ups happen. I mean, I think, as Matt and has pointed out, during the events themselves, people tend to act pretty well, and they do what they need to do to get out of a deathly situation. And it's really after the fact. And it might be that's a way, and I'm thinking about this just in terms of kind of trying to convince people of the logic of capitalism and the appeal of libertarianism is actually, it might be more by focusing after the floods. You know, that's really when things get fucked up, because the crisis has passed, and we don't allow basic supply and demand to operate normally.
I don't disagree with you about that, but I actually think this is a hill we should die on. I mean, I think the idea of unequal distribution of resources as a reason not to let people make money is a core thing that we should be sticking up for in every circumstance. And that includes fancy pants rich people getting to genetically engineer their perfect babies first, all the way down to the guy who puts some bottles of water in his pickup truck. And of course it's true that Walmart used to be seen as a villain in these circumstances, because they did occasionally raise prices, and they managed to do some great PR by giving away stuff for free in Florida, as well as in after Katrina. But again, the people who, in the moment when there is nothing, when there would be nothing, when there is no water, the guy who gets down there and sells water, he's a good guy. He's our guy. We should be sticking up for him.
Let me make a final point and kind of extend where Nick was going with this, with the post storm things. Right now, there's a lot of stupid, nasty, preemptive politics, where I think Pete King of New York, the IRA's own Pete King, was poking vitriol in the direction of Ted Cruz and also a bunch of House Republicans who, in his description, voted against helping out people after Hurricane Sandy. That also happened during the presidential campaign contretemps between Chris Christie and Rand Paul. And one of the points of federal disaster relief, all of which has just been, I mean, that's the real hockey stick in American life, is not only how much money we have spent on disaster relief since, I think, Hurricane Andrew was the real floodgates on this. That's an accurate metaphor, Catherine. Back in 1992, and I think Glenn Garvin had a really wonderful piece for us more than 20 years ago describing that under the first Bush administration, but also the numbers of just anything that's declared a national federal emergency or disaster. This is obviously one of them. But what it does, like anything else in government, like funding the troops or whatever, that is seen to be everybody in the world wants to do it. So much of politics is about getting, and about governance is about finding an issue that everybody knows, every good and honest, decent person has to be in favor of. And that's where the real graft happens, because the Hurricane Sandy relief, which didn't actually affect a lot of people for many years near where I live, where there was a lot of Sandy damage. It's Superstorm Sandy, technically. It's because people get in front of it and use that money for all kinds of crap. Also true of 9/11 disaster relief. The New York Times rebuilt their corporate offices with 9/11 money, for crying out loud. So we see this graft go in, because what kind of monstrous politician would ever be against throwing this number of billions of dollars? And the same thing will happen in Houston. A lot of that money will be misspent, and it'll only be monsters like Catherine who will object to the way that it is spent.
And I will say, you know who else is with me on this? As per last week's podcast, Jeff Flake, who voted against the Sandy relief, and as far as I can see, has been unrepentant about that. Sandy, I think, Matt, you can correct me if I'm wrong, was particularly larded up with kind of projects people had been trying to push through forever that they jumped on the emergency to toss in there. There are better and worse versions, and Sandy was particularly bad, which I think is why more people than usual managed to man up and vote against it. But the vote to expand the borrowing power of the flood relief program, that was unanimous. So that's what they'll be operating on, at least in the short run, in Texas.
Hey, Matt, contretemps, what does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I read
are you just making up French phrases? Are you bluffing?
It means like a kerfuffle. It means
a dust up.
Dust up, yeah.
A brouhaha.
Yeah.
Right. I'm okay. I will add that to my coffee table book. And Matt, also, you had earlier when we first started discussing the issue, you spoke favorably of the Coast Guard. So in situations like this, do you think they do a fairly good job? Do you think FEMA does a poor job? What does the federal response generally look like? And does some of it deserve praise?
I mean, the Coast Guard was arguably the single most effective organization during Hurricane Katrina. They never stopped flying helicopters, even when there was widespread disinformation spread by all kinds of people, including the New Orleans sheriff, including Tiger Woods, including everybody that the Katrina victims were sitting on their rooftops shooting at helicopters. It was one of the worst, arguably most deadly urban legends that have been out there that delayed a lot of the delivery of relief to the Superdome and other places because they're afraid that, like, you know, super predators were out there and dismissing relief and being violent about
them. There were bodies rotting in the Superdome.
Oh, my.
They were stabbing
babies, Nick.
Well, and actually... They were. Yeah. They was babies.
They were stabbing babies with other babies.
Yes.
It was just Reason's,
baby shiv. Reason's own Jesse Walker actually has written some great stuff over the years about disaster response and particularly about fear mongering, about looting, which politicians almost always participate in, which keeps people in their homes during these events. People are worried that somehow their nice law-abiding neighbors turn into characters from Grand Theft Auto when they get damp. And so they stay in their houses, which is, as Matt said, it's a horrible, deadly result of what's really just not true. In fact, what people do in bad storms is blow up their little kids' wading pool and stick old ladies in them and save the day.
Yeah,
well, so well done, human beings.
The Coast Guard was very brave, using their helicopters well under adverse circumstances. Then evacuated a lot of people. And it's too early; it's the fog of war right now down in Houston. But I've seen at least quite a few pictures of the Coast Guard doing it. This is what they're good at. They're guarding the coast. We're in Houston. They're doing search and rescue. So in addition to the Cajun Navy, I presume that the Coast Guard's doing a pretty good job.
Nice. Well, so I'm going to award a point to the Cajun Navy, a point to the Coast Guard, and subtract a point from Catherine on principle. And I will also subtract a point from Joe Arpaio, who is probably having a fairly good weekend. Joe Arpaio was pardoned, I believe, Friday by President Trump. And if you're unfamiliar with him, Joe Arpaio purported to be the toughest sheriff in the country from Maricopa County, Arizona, so kind of near the Phoenix area. And by toughest sheriff in the county, what that meant was kind of the old school throw a brick at felons type logic of put people in terrible, terrible living conditions with 120 degree heat out in tents outside, give them barely edible food, let brutal guards beat the crap out of them, have them get raped a couple times, and eventually they'll learn their lesson and become dentists. And that will be how the criminal justice system will prosper. However, what he got in trouble for, if I'm not mistaken, is for racial profiling of Latinos, because he was a very big anti-illegal immigrant guy and would, among other fun things, regularly hold undocumented immigrants past their court-ordered release dates to ensure they'd be picked up by immigration agents. He'd do things so that if they were picked up, it would be a felonious charge and they'd go to prison rather than be sent back. So eventually was ordered by the courts to knock it off. He not only kept doing all of the things that the courts had told him not to do, he bragged about them publicly and so was held in contempt of court. So that brings us up to a couple of years ago. He also supported President Trump and was a very big vocal supporter of Trump going back to when he got into the race and even prior to that. They were both kind of on team Obama is from another country. And Friday, President Trump pardoned him. I imagine we're probably not big Arpaio fans here. Nick, I want to kick it to you. I've seen a lot of articles about this undermining rule of law. Is this something that's legal? Is it something that is meritorious? And should we worry about it undermining rule of law?
And you're talking about the president's ability to pardon people. My limited understanding of it is that there's no question that Trump has the right to do this. I think it's a complete stupid move. And, you know, Arpaio is the type of sheriff or the type of lawman who really undermines all kinds of confidence and trust in the rule of law, because he was under, you know, court orders to stop doing what he was doing. He was in contempt of actual law, in doing what he was doing. And the idea that he would be rewarded with a pardon from the president for that, a man who says he believes in law and order, it really forces all of us to acknowledge that when people talk about law and order, it is a code word for a kind of over-policed society that borders on fascism, where the guys with the guns and the nightsticks make the rules as they go along, and that they are not held to the same standards. I think, Justin Amash denounced the pardon, the libertarian representative from Michigan, and I think he's exactly right about that. And this is the type of stuff that is particularly frustrating, I think, in Donald Trump's America, where you have somebody who says he's in favor of the rule of law, and he's doing everything possible to actually undermine anybody's belief that authority is more than occasionally legitimate and within its bounds and doing what it's doing.
Catherine, do you know why we have presidential pardons? What is the theory behind it, and does it actually serve any useful purpose?
Heaton, I don't know why you're always like, hey, could you just real quick be an expert on the Constitution? I don't know. It's in the Constitution. They thought it was a good idea. It's right there. Trump is within his rights to pardon Arpaio, as Nick said. And I think it's actually interesting how frequently Donald Trump's actions wind up causing all of us to have to do remedial lessons in balance of powers and constitutional history, because he does keep running up against these walls. It is true. He is allowed to pardon anyone he wants. He can do it even before the sentencing, as he did in this case. I've been trying to look for silver linings because everything's bad. And my silver lining here is that lots of people who never heard of Arpaio suddenly care deeply about him as of this weekend, because they hate Donald Trump so much. And a lot of the stuff that Arpaio did, although he did it in a particularly spectacular, flashy way, and he did a lot of awful things, many of the practices that he engaged in that are now catching people's rage are pretty common, right? So people are like, he shackled a woman in labor to a bed? How dare he? Happens all the time. He used stun guns repeatedly on prisoners who were already cuffed and disabled? Happens all the time. Overcrowding? Happens all the time. Punishing prisoners by making them eat food that has no flavor? Happens all the time. So I hope at least that as we sort of look at these tweet storms of litanies of Arpaio's sins, that people will become a little bit more aware that he's not the only guy that was pulling this garbage. But I think from the constitutional perspective, people are sort of missing the point when they're saying Trump doesn't care about the rule of law. It's like, well, Arpaio doesn't care about the rule of law. That much is clear. But Trump is within his rights to pardon.
Right, but there is a sense in which this signals Trump not being too interested in some of the elements of the rule of law, even as he's exercising his just and proper constitutional powers, which is that Arpaio, and not just in this particular case, but pursuant to this particular case, was in defiance of a court order about violating people's civil liberties. Trump is signaling to all local law enforcement, and let's keep in mind that yesterday, in the middle of a pretty busy news weekend, Trump was like, hey, Sheriff David Clark's got a great book out. And Clark from Milwaukee is arguably as notorious or close to being as notorious as Joe Arpaio is in terms of just horrifying mistreatment of prisoners and willful disregard to the civil liberty of suspected civil liberties of suspected criminals. So that's a pretty unmistakable signal from the president of the United States that if you're local law enforcement, we want you out there bending the rules, breaking them if necessary. I got your back as long as you do it in the name of being tough on crime and in the name of combating illegal immigration. Point I want to make about Joe Arpaio and kind of Trump's role with him. It's easy to say, oh, my God, this is some new Trump thing. And Trump, as always, extends it in places or to places that hadn't been contemplated previously. However, Republicans have been kissing the ring of Joe Arpaio for more than 20 years, nationally and locally, and with very few exceptions. He's been a huge power player in Arizona politics and Phoenix politics. Mitt Romney, who's being held up as, like, you know, the conscience of the Republican Party, he's going to call Donald Trump out for the bigotry that he really has. He nominated, he appointed Joe Arpaio as his campaign, honorary state chairman in 2007. And the reporting on it at the time, Arpaio's like, yeah, the first thing he asked me is like, how are those pink underwear prisoners doing? Yuck, yuck, yuck. Mitt Romney, who arguably pulled the Republican Party much more in the direction of Joe Arpaio on immigration. Let's not forget, Romney discovered that he almost elbowed out both John McCain and Rudy Giuliani, who were the primary competition in the 2008 presidential campaign. Immigration was his issue, because back then Giuliani was the avatar of sanctuary cities back then. And so Romney beat him up on that. Romney beat up McCain for being a part of back then comprehensive immigration reform and these types of things. So Republicans have been doing this for a long time. Rick Perry came to try to get the Joe Arpaio endorsement this past time. Arizona politicians as well, with a few exceptions. And one of those exceptions is John McCain. I think Flake also has never been a big fan of Arpaio. But it speaks to where the Republican Party has gone, devolved to on immigration over a period of years, from kind of a high watermark of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush back in their famous 1980 debate, where they're kind of competing with one another to be the people who thought that we should stop treating illegal immigration as a criminality issue as opposed to a prohibition issue, and how we can open the borders both ways in Ronald Reagan's terms. Well, this devolved, and it devolved rapidly over a long period of time. Trump is taking advantage of a kind of fervor that Republicans themselves, including Mitt Romney, whipped up along with the Joe Arpaios of the world, but never quite had the courage to try to completely follow up on in terms of enforcement. So this is a long-term problem that Republicans have self-inflicted upon themselves. It's disgusting. It's vile. It's anti-civil liberties. It's anti any kind of sense of rule of law. And it really speaks to the complete lack of character of Donald Trump, especially at a time when there's a lot of people who have questions about his priorities and the signaling that he gives in issues of sensitive law enforcement and racial minorities.
The tidbit that's really killing me on this Arpaio stuff is when asked about the timing of the pardon, and in particular why it was done before the sentencing, which is very unusual. There's been some sort of murmurs out of the Trump White House of like, oh, well, you know, we were just trying to save people money. We were trying to save the taxpayers money and the judicial system money, because, you know, it takes money to do this stuff, and there could be appeals. It's like, there have been more than $100 million of settlements and criminal proceedings and civil proceedings against this man already. It's too late to save the taxpayers' money in the judiciary. Arpaio has a decades-long record of just being sued and sued and sued and sued, and sometimes settling for all kinds of horrific stuff, including charges of sexual assault on his watch, including deaths in his prisons. The idea that, like, well, let's just, this last $1 million it was going to take to finish the formalities of this legal proceeding, you should thank us, America, for saving you that cash.
The other interesting kind of potential signal that this is sending is to people who are close to Donald Trump as various investigations get underway. And about their ability to be pardoned. So, whether it's Mike Flynn or whoever, in the administration or Paul Manafort to clam up. And, you know, one of the things that Trump has done in a way that, you know, and Bill Clinton in a way pioneered this in terms of being shameless that he would go where people didn't expect him to go. And I think Clinton, his prime moments for that were really when he launched attacks on the day that Monica Lewinsky was testifying before a grand jury. He launched attacks on Al-Qaeda hideouts in various countries around the globe. And then he also started bombing in the former Yugoslavia on the first day of his impeachment trial. Trump has taken all of that kind of shamelessness to a new level where he will do, if you can think it, he will do it. It's almost like being in a bizarre science fiction novel where you, whatever the worst thoughts you have may come true. And it's almost as Americans, we need to refuse to like indulge in our worst thoughts about what Donald Trump is capable of, because he's probably going to do it. And so he almost certainly is would be willing to pardon anybody who is being investigated by, you know, special prosecutors, special counsels, things like that.
Am I right in thinking that it is a somewhat common practice for presidents to pardon a bunch of people their last day of office so they can kind of quietly get their campaign buddies out of the jail?
Yeah, I mean, okay. So he's Barack Obama, for example. One of his worst pardons, arguably his worst, was, and I'll probably screw up the name, Oscar Lopez Rivera. Is that right, Nick? The Puerto Rican nationalist murderer, if I am not mistaken. And it's like, you know, someone who commits political murder, we don't need to pardon that person. We're good. They're fine. I think it was a commutation, not a pardon, but. The typical thing is that you do that. Jimmy Carter, I think it was late in his term when he pardoned the Vietnam draft dodgers. Bill Clinton, infamous pardon of Mark Rich, who, like Joe Arpaio, was not repentant in any way, shape, or form, as far as I know. And also, like Joe Arpaio, had some connections to Bill Clinton politically. So yeah, you do that. Obama started to use his commutation and pardoning power in a systematic way late in his or midway through his second and final term to start to redress some of the excess sentencing excesses of the drug war. We wrote about that a lot at Reason, and I encourage people to look at those archives. We all wish that he would have done more of that. I think he was pretty cautious, but that activity ramped up a whole lot on both numbers and percentage as his during the waning months and days of his presidency.
Yeah, that sounds like with Obama commuting sentences of drug offenders or pardoning them, and President Carter pardoning draft dodgers. That seems to me to be more of a focus of enforcement and in terms of resources of who we're going to prosecute, as opposed to just doling out favors and exempting people from the judicial process, which seems to me to be what's happening with Arpaio and with a lot of the people you mentioned, Nick. I'm sorry, Matt.
Yeah,
Matt.
No, and. But, well, I mean, it's I think, you know, that's a distinction worth drawing. And again, I just to follow up on what Matt was saying, you know, the pardon power is not a bad thing necessarily. And I think, Andrew, you're hinting at something where when it's particular, you know, if it's a general dynamic or there is a broader understanding about how things have changed, that's kind of, you know, that's probably a better use than individual people that may or may not have committed heinous crimes.
And keep in mind that, you know, from folks inside the Trump administration, there was even an acknowledgement over the weekend of like, haha, looks like not too many people are noticing this Arpaio thing, thanks to Hurricane Harvey, Hardy Har. Like, I think it's always telling to see when the pardon drops, and a Friday afternoon pardon is a pardon that somebody somewhere knows they shouldn't be proud of.
It was definitely something of a contretemps, in my opinion. That they
nicely
thank you
done.
Very much. I wrote it down and I'm using it. So lots of people angry at President Trump for this and for a variety of other reasons. One of the names that I am now seeing kind of bandied about, at least here in New York with my degenerate comedian friends, as a possible contender against Donald Trump is Senator Al Franken of Minnesota, who is surprisingly popular. And I say that not really in relation to him, but just the fact that he is a senator and he's so popular. The last poll I saw was something like 63%, which is really well above both Trump and Congress as a whole. He was a Saturday Night Live writer and performer, so he came into politics through comedy, and then wound up winning, I think it was a 2008 election, I think, by about 312 votes against the sitting Republican. And so he is now a possible contender in 2020 to go up against President Trump. Matt, I am a comedian, or at least try to be funny. On principle, should I back him? I ask this because I don't actually know what his individual politics are beyond the fact that he is a Democrat. I don't know if he's a moderate or a populist. I don't know how centrist he is. Is he evil? What do you think?
No, you should not back another entertainer as president, if only because for your next appearance on Fox, when they do the inevitable segment of like, can you believe that this famous person said something about politics? My go-to retort is like, yeah, that's why I don't vote for people who are entertainers to become president. You asshole. Franken, from what I can tell, he tries to govern Senate in the Paul Wellstone Minnesota kind of progressive liberal tradition. I'm no fan of him at all, and not even as a comedian, except for his Mick Jagger impersonation, which was bizarrely phenomenal back in the day with a knee. It was like knee pads era, 1982 Mick Jagger is pretty darn good. He was this is the lowest bar possible, but compared to most Democrats during the confirmation hearings process. He was not entirely awful. He was actually using some of his ability to cross-examine about issues that occasionally mattered, in addition to some that didn't matter. So at least he has that going from it. It shows me the fact that he's a trial balloon here. Once again, just the absolute emptiness, not thinness, but emptiness of the Democrat bench at this point in terms of talented name recognition politicians. He might be the best that they have, and he's like a pretty much unfunny comedian from Minnesota. But the Democrats have been wiped out, and they haven't been able. They remind me of Republicans during much of the Obama era, with the exception of the kind of Tea Party ferment out there. You have kind of a historically unpopular Republican president right now, and an entire generation of people in millennials and even people younger in Gen Z who are, you know, the Republican brand will be toxic forever. So this should be the most fertile ground possible for the Democratic Party, yet they are going to find ways to keep screwing it up, to keep making the issue about $15 minimum wages and whether we should tear down every single statue out there that's ever been contemplated, instead of connecting with people on some better policy level. So I just see him more as a symptom of the ongoing problem of the Democratic Party, which is that people are sitting around right now. I've seen them do it today, this morning on Twitter, like, all right, Joe Biden, it's really going to be him next time. Like, Jesus Christ, is it really that bad for your party?
I agree. I was just about to say the words Joe Biden right there. Like, the fact that Joe Biden is a thing happening in the world at all right now is all the evidence you need for the bankruptcy of the Democratic Party. But if the next best choice is Al Franken, then, you know, I guess we should just go ahead and resign ourselves to Trump's second term.
Lord help me, but I'm about to say very positive things about Al Franken, because he's been like, you know, kind of in the way that when Hillary Clinton became a senator from New York, she kept something of a low profile and became well known for constituent service, and she was liked by her colleagues in the Senate. And Al Franken has pulled the same thing off as senator from Minnesota. He squeaked by in an election which probably could have been contested, and I mean there was a recount or a a check on it and everything. But he's, you know, he's a serious politician now, despite his often awful, pre-career at SNL and elsewhere. And I think, I think you guys are reading it wrong in the sense of somebody like Al Franken as a performer or somebody with those chops. And remember, he also wrote, you know, a couple of books that were bestsellers, taking down media figures like Rush Limbaugh from a liberal progressive position. And he knows how to counter people like Donald Trump. I don't think he would get into the gutter the same way that Trump has, in terms of, talking about Carly Fiorina's face and stuff like that. But he would know how to dish it out. And I also think to millennials, one of the things that's emerging as Democrats are starting to really scramble for somebody to run against Trump in 2020, whether or not you win that, you want to have a strong showing. There are more and more concerns that the Democrats have embraced identity politics and, ideas about, that American society has never been more racist, more sexist, more homophobic, to the exclusion of economic issues. And Franken actually talks a lot about that. He talks a lot about health care for all. He talks about $15 minimum wages. And while I think those ideas are not just misguided, but really, really stupid and dangerous to an economy that is already running on fumes, he does a pretty good case of that. And if you want to lock down the millennial vote, that is a guy who can actually talk a very good game and will present a very different face to younger voters, that the economy matters. And he comes from a part of the country that has been hit hard by the ongoing deindustrialization of the American economy. I think Al Franken is like Donald Trump. Like, I think you underestimate him at your own peril if you're a politician running against him.
I also think, though, that there's something to be said here just on the pure armchair psychology point of view. Like, I'm already deeply skeptical of anyone who thinks they can or should be president. I think that suggests a certain kind of pathological mindset. And apologies to Andrew Heaton here. I'm also deeply skeptical of people who are comedians. So to bring those two things together, in a single human being who has been trying to get people to laugh at him desperately for the first half of his career and now desperately wants people to vote for him, possibly 51% of the American people. I just think there's a certain psychological type I'd rather not indulge in there. And Trump is a variant of that type.
You're making me like him more. He's desperate. I appreciate that. Desperation.
You hear yourself? Yeah. Okay.
I'm his native constituent. Why, just out of curiosity, would Joe Biden be such a horrific selection for the Democratic Party?
Are you fucking kidding?
Hold on.
I'm
not. Like, because it seems to me that they can go one of three or four routes, right? They can embrace a fiery populist like Elizabeth Warren. They can get a technocrat like Hillary Clinton, or they can go for a centrist moderate. I don't think it would necessarily work, but it's a strategy that they've often used in the past.
Joe Biden is not a centrist moderate, and Joe Biden, among other things, was he was the person who basically created the drug czar's office as senator of the United States. He has been on the wrong side of virtually every major issue from a libertarian perspective. He rarely, if ever, has met a government program that he doesn't want to expand or start up or revive, like Frankenstein's monster with a jolt of electricity. There is very little. He's a hawk's hawk. He has been chided down. He was a national laughingstock until he became Obama's vice president, and he played the role of elder statesman during Obama's very rocky first few years. And it was really a sign of desperation that we were looking to Joe Biden as kind of like the senior counsel in the White House. But Joe Biden, and that is all to say that, as R. Kelly says at various legal proceedings, insists that age ain't nothing but a number. But Joe Biden, like Hillary Clinton, like Donald Trump, is very, and like Elizabeth Warren for that matter, these are old people who are so locked into a 20th century experience and mentality. I think it's safe to say, they should have nice retirements, but we should not be letting them drive the car any longer. It's time to take away the keys from people like that, especially those who have a demonstrated record of mediocrity or infringing on almost every kind of freedom and civil liberty when they're actually in charge. And that's not even getting into the stuff in the Obama administration. I mean, like the Obama administration, besides Obamacare, terrible on civil liberties, terrible on foreign policy, terrible on economic policy. And we should never, you know, we can forgive, but we should never forget.
That's an excellently succinct and detailed case. And just pursuant to add on to that, to Catherine's point about Franken, Joe Biden's been running for president since 1976. There's something wrong with that boy. At some point,
yeah. Didn't he name his dog Senator or something? And he I think got elected as early as he possibly could.
It's a very, very strange need to constantly be running for president. And let's just never forget him heading up the task force recovery through retrofit. That's we were going to weatherize ourselves to a booming economy in the early Obama days. That was Joe Biden's baby.
Also, I'm pretty sure in like the last 6 weeks of the Obama presidency, he was supposed to cure cancer, and he hasn't. So that should be a point against him.
You know, he was busy. He had stuff going on, Catherine. I just, you know, there's a lot. You got a lot to do. Your points are well taken. Although I do find him very likable. And I will say that I think he has less of a everyone who disagrees with me is evil bent than some of the other people that I've seen in politics, which I do kind of like, at least temperamentally.
You don't know. He's just smiling while he hates you.
Well, that's possible too. But remember, I'm from the middle of the country, so we're very good at that. So the whole platform we're doing of sort of fake friendliness, mediocrity, and desperation. Again, all of these things sound like bumper sticker issues for me, but may not be good for people that you know, live in America otherwise.
Yeah, people with a future. You're right.
Well, I'm going to pivot away from the potential nascent Biden and Franken ticket and drag our attention to Berkeley, where right-wing demonstrators gathered in Berkeley Square over the weekend for a No to Marxism in Berkeley rally. And they were met by not just counter-protesters, which we can anticipate, given that that is the pastime of Berkeley, but by the Antifa. And Antifa, if you're not familiar with them, means anti-fascist. It's a group of people that oftentimes, oftentimes use or avowedly use violence as a tactic to suppress what they view as nascent fascism. And so they're coming in, and there was violence. People got beaten up. Cops had to get involved. Nick, who are these people? What are they? Yeah, who are they?
Well, the Antifa are a loose aggregation of, you know, decentralized groups of black-clad, mask-wearing anti-fascists who show up wherever they think hate speech is being tolerated. And one of their rallying cries is that hate speech is not free speech. And unlike a lot of people in American society, they do not minimize the fact that they will resort to violence very quickly, if not as a first, measure to suppress thoughts and beliefs that they find unconscionable. And I think, you know, they were also at work in Berkeley earlier this year. They helped shut down planned events at the college by Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos. The event in Berkeley yesterday was kind of interesting because you mentioned it was it kind of followed on the heels of a Say No to Marxism rally that was basically called off in San Francisco on Saturday, and then it was taken over by a kind of right-wingy group that may or may not have had some connections to the alt-right. But then the big, you know, group that was there yesterday were, you know, as many as 7,000 people were counter-protesters who were saying, you know, say no to hate. And then the Antifa shows up and starts hitting people. I think it's something like 5 people were injured, including a couple of right-wingers, including a couple of people who, to allude to what Matt was talking about earlier, to call back to that, who were not necessarily right-wingers at all, but just got kind of mistaken for stuff. I see the Antifa very much as a kind kind of counter or mirror to the alt-right or to the more violent parts of the alt-right and the kind of neo-Nazi white supremacist movement. And they really kind of need each other. They're, by all accounts, it's hard to know how many of them there are, but we know that it's not very many. But the what they want to do is to engage in a kind of romance of revolutionary violence, street theater, violence as street theater. And it's, you know, it's a dangerous movement. And in many ways, it's a distillation of some of the suppression of free speech that you see on college campuses and in other parts of American society. And, I have a piece up at Reason today about it. And my one hope is that between the rise of a kind of explicit neo-Nazi white supremacist movement that you saw in Charlottesville, where people were actually carrying Nazi flags and Confederate stars and bars and chanting Jews will not replace us and blood and soil and things like that. On the far left, you have the Antifa, which are quick to go to violence. And it's I'm hoping that it will unite liberals, conservatives, and libertarians in a really sharp defense of the idea of the marketplace of ideas, that everybody has a right to free speech, everybody has a right to peaceable assembly, and we need to be tolerant of people who we think are living in error, but we also need to be free to speak up and to show up and be able to protest, counter-protest, and represent our own beliefs in a marketplace of ideas. That's the only thing that I can see coming good out of the rise of the Antifa.
Well, so, I mean, Nick, it kind of sounds to me like they're the alt-left that Trump described in his kind of rambling and infamous press conference a couple of weeks ago. When Trump says that there are, you know, bad people on both sides, is he referring to these people, and is that equivocating correct?
No, well, look, there are two things. What Trump said that was actually more problematic in that press conference is that there were good people on both sides. And it's really hard to say, there are good Nazis, because like if you're walking carrying a Nazi flag, you have a right to do that and, more power to you. And I'm sure those Nazi flags are made in China or Mexico. So it's good that those people are getting work. But it's like, there aren't good Nazis. And there also are not good anti-fascists if they believe that America is so damaged and so awful that a response to violence is a legitimate, like, out-of-the-box violence and going up and clubbing people and beating people because of what they believe. That is so far from what we might consider as, responsible or even permissible behavior in a libertarian world where you believe in, both rights of free speech, which, and in the First Amendment is also as importantly as it is about speech and religion, it's about the right of assembly. But to be able to talk about stuff without having to worry about getting sucker punched, Reason is against punching Nazis, and it's against punching non-Nazis, unless there is a real and pressing threat. They are, in that sense, they're the alt-left that Trump is talking about, but Trump needs them too. Because, go back to the Joe Arpaios of the world and the law and order people who want to suppress ideas that they don't like through threats of violence or acts of violence. These people are made for each other. And what we need to do, I think, is understand that in the center, being in the center does not mean being moderate. Libertarians, I think, are in the center of the American political spectrum, as most people define it. I mean, we're socially tolerant and we're fiscally responsible. That puts us in the center, not the fringes. It doesn't mean that we're mushy moderates or compromised people. It means that we actually stand up for, the ideals of an America that is based on, the First Amendment rights to free speech, free religion, and free assembly. And that's what we need to be arguing about and fighting back to keep people like this, whether they're on the right or the left, from really gaining any kind of ground or legitimacy, or allowing us to think that the government has a right to become more violent and more
suppressive.
Two
quick add-on points to that. One is that they are consciously trying to engage in a heckler's veto by putting up a price of disorder on any planned right-wing, alt-right gathering. They are saying to local communities, don't issue those people permits. And you have idiots like Nancy Pelosi agreeing with them, and other people in New York and other kind of blue states kind of saying, well, we can't guarantee the peace here, so we won't be able to allow these people to have a peaceable assembly. So that's part of what they're doing. The other thing is, it's from this crowd that we got the, you know, rounds of discussion online of, you know, the supposed ethics of, can we punch a Nazi? Famously, I think, and it was an Antifa person who punched Richard Spencer while he was talking to a reporter during the inauguration festivities. And as we pointed out here on this podcast and elsewhere, the big problem, one of many big problems with sucker punching anybody, of people that you would imagine are Nazis, is who died and allowed you to decide who is and who is not a Nazi. I was talking with Jacob Siegel from the Daily Beast on the Fifth Column podcast last week. He was at the Boston rally, and one thing that he said was that the first thing that he saw in Boston was Antifa jump on and snatch out of the hands of the 60, 70-year-old woman, white woman, an American flag, and start trashing it, and she fell to the ground, and they went and ran with the flag because they assumed that she was pro-Trump. She was anti-Trump. So they attacked a Nazi who was probably just a liberal Boston grandma who had an American flag. You always get that problem. They're going to punch the wrong Nazi. It's going to be an act of aggression. I'm not the guy who walks around with a non-aggression principle tattooed on my forehead or anything like that. But the general idea of violence is that it should be executed in self-defense, not in offense. And these assholes do it in offense. And we saw that yesterday in Berkeley.
Catherine, when I was reading about this, one of the things that I thought was interesting was that the sort of loose conglomeration that Nick referred to included people that described themselves as anarchists. But I also suspect that if you were to talk to them, they'd probably want a very strong single-payer healthcare system and a robust environmental regulatory network and that kind of thing. Do you think that the terms fascism and anarchism and all of these sort of ideologically loaded terms are used strategically at all?
Sure, they're used strategically, but I think that they are losing their meaning, perhaps even more rapidly than they were before. I mean, people are always going to be literalist about the names of political groups, right? When you say to a certain type of liberal, oh, such and such a person is a conservative, they're like, well, then why don't you want the whole world to just freeze and stop and be exactly the same forever, huh? That's conservation. And, you know, there's always the libertarians who want to get the word liberal back. Like, this is the year that we get that word back. Which, you know, a noble but utterly lost cause. And I think that the rise of Antifa is probably the end of whatever minimal understanding we had of the real definition of fascism. That word was already pretty much just used to mean people who suck and I hate. But we're now fully in a place where, as you quite rightly point out, people using the word anarchist who favor giant overweening state power, people who say, you know, oh, I'm anti-fascist, but basically support the violent suppression of speech that they disagree with. So in some cases by the state as well as by a cheerful volunteer band of black clad protesters. So, yeah, I think all these words are always, always losing their meaning and being redefined. And I suspect that Antifa is the death blow to any kind of historically literate understanding of the word fascism, at the very least.
Yeah, I don't like them. I'll be the first to say it. If they invited me to a cocktail party, I don't think I would go. I would turn it down.
I would actually fully go in the hopes that it would just be a totally normal cocktail party.
People playing cards against humanity wearing ninja costumes.
Yeah, everyone just like stood around. Because the fact is, most of these people in their day-to-day lives, they are not actually living in a world of full-fledged 24/7 revolution. They put on their bandana, they hit an old lady with an American flag, and then they run away again and go back to college.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Okay, I'll reconsider if they invite me. I'll think about it.
And same with the Nazis, to be honest. I mean, we should probably turn down all cocktail party invitations from now on. But, you know, the guys with the tiki torches who looked like suburban dads, they were suburban dads. And that's always worth keeping in mind, that even these like ultra radical protesters are at Home Depot. They got those torches on a discount.
I was going to say, and also where they were working at a libertarian hot dog stand in Berkeley that then fired them for showing right. up at that, a, that at was a Nazi great. March. Yeah, this is, again, you know, the Antifa really draw heavily from Herbert Marcuse and a couple of other kind of Frankfurt School 60s era counterculture theorists. Who Marcuse in particular talked about repressive tolerance, which was the idea that liberal democracy maintained a status quo that was horrible and unjust by, you know, the show of tolerance, of letting people speak their minds and pretending that there was progress. So in 1965, Marcuse really articulated repressive tolerance in kind of peak form, just as civil rights acts were being passed and major, major structural changes were being made to American society to make it fairer and more participatory. And that's what these guys are calling back to. And it was wrong then, and it's wrong now. But this goes to that, you know, the theme that I think I've been beating to death for a long time now, of if when people lose a belief that the system is just and that it is open to change and that it will get better, you do get, you know, groups like the alt-right and the alt-left. And, you know, it's up to those of us who actually believe in the basic ideals of American society as a kind of, articulated in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and actually even Washington's Farewell Address, which was kind of secular scripture during the 19th century and really lays out a lot of interesting stuff that is worth talking about. And John Avlin, the Daily Beast editor, had a great book that came out earlier this year about it. But if we believe in this system, we need to make those principles of freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom to live life as you want to, as long as you are not, you know, grotesquely infringing in other people's rights. We need to, you know, stand up for those, articulate them in new ways for a new America, and really, and be willing to fight for them, because these are fringe groups, and they will go back to, you know, the coffee clutches of Berkeley or of Northern Virginia, where the American Nazi Party was headquartered in its heyday. Once more and more people are kind of enfranchised in the idea that there is a system, an American system, that provides opportunity and redress for people.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on, both optimistic and condemnatory of Antifa. You've been listening to The Reason Podcast. Thank you for doing so. If you're doing so from Houston, we wish you the best and invite you to stay in Catherine Mangue Ward's basement for as long as you need. And while you're there,
I am going to charge
you. She will charge you millions of dollars to do it, because she is fine with price gouging. While you're there, like and subscribe to us on iTunes. And until next time,